to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing?
Hey, Mark. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Just, you know, it's been even more about smartphones this week. I know last week we talked a little bit about it. We had Amazon and the Kindles, and now we've got Apple and the iPhone 5. And all the mania around that.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday was that's all it was there. And is there any other launch left? I guess nothing else left at this point in terms of the phones for the fall season.
Yeah, I mean, you had Nokia phones came out, and you know, that's pretty much the biggest ones that we know. I'm sure there'll be more to come, but.
Motorola came out, Google Motorola came out already.
Right.
Then Nokia, then, yeah, Apple, yeah, those are the big ones.
So are you at all tempted by the other phones? You're an iPhone guy, right?
I am an iPhone guy, but it's funny. I was tweeting back and forth with Dorian, who's your business manager, right?
Right.
And we were tweeting back and forth this morning. He was saying that he's having gadget fatigue, and he said, "Am I the only one who doesn't want to buy the new Kindle, the new iPhone, or anything?" I said, "No, you're not alone. I'm in the same bucket at this point." So
it's kind of like you're already happy with what you've got. Why do you need to get the next one? I mean, I've got an iPhone 4, and I'm pretty happy with it. Do I need like another inch? Do I need it to be bigger, stronger? You know, and all that. I mean, that's a questionable, I guess.
Yeah, and iPhone 4S came out in the last year, so at this point, I'm maxed out on anything I can justify to buy, and with Kindle as well. After Kindle Fire, I used Kindle Fire week one, and I haven't picked it up since then.
It's basically just gathering dust for you.
I don't even know where it is, but yes, it's somewhere in the house.
When you moved, basically all of your gadgets that were not top of mind are all just still packed away somewhere.
That's probably, yeah, that's exactly what it is. And between the Kindle, the old school Kindle that I have, which is not touchscreen, and iPhone, and a first generation iPad, and a MacBook Air, I mean, the money I'll spend is the money I'll spend on getting the best work laptop. And so a MacBook Air, the new MacBook Air that just announced, that's what I got. Other than that, I don't really need it. So I guess that would be an interesting thing to see for the early adopters, that a lot of these companies have been basing their hopes on to first buy and then spread the word. Are we finally reaching a fatigue point, or this is just a temporary thing? Because I'm beginning to hear from other people as well.
Yeah, and I think the question really is, you know, we're used to, you know, having your computer or your laptop, you know, usually the life cycle is, I don't know, 3-4 years at least, and then you get a new one. But with smartphones, which are basically a smaller version of a computer, or with tablets, it feels like they're trying to make it more of an every year purchase or upgrade or every couple years. So I think maybe that's part of the fatigue, is just that they're trying to really make you update so much more rapidly.
And also now the innovation on the gadget front is really evolutionary at this point. Sorry, incremental at this point. So unless something complete, like when iPhone came out, it was a huge jump of what the market was, or even the first few iPhones.
This is much more incremental now.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the screen has been increased, but I guess Samsung had done that a while ago. And yes, the maps, Apple has like cool flyover stuff, but Google Earth has the same thing. Turn by turn directions, but Google had the same thing. So Siri, okay, now slightly better Siri, but it was useless before. Now it's even more useless now.
Well, we'll talk to our gadget freaks and see what they have to say. See whether they're seeing the same thing that we're seeing, and whether, I mean, I'm guessing they've got a little bit of overkill just because they're the ones who have to review things. So first we'll talk about The iPhone 5 and that announcement, as well as all the other smartphones that have come out. And we'll have Nicole Lee, who's formerly at CNET and will be at Engadget. And we'll also have Matt Buchanan from BuzzFeed. And then we'll talk about a new book out by BJ Mendelsohn, Social Media is Bullshit, and his take about the overhyped social media marketing machine and all the people who kind of sell what could be considered the snake oil of social media marketing. But first, let's talk about the iPhone 5 and new smartphones. So Apple made another big splash with its new Superman iPhone, bigger, faster, stronger, with more apps and a new connector. On the good side, you're getting more for the same price tag, but Apple's also pushing out YouTube and Google Maps from the home screen in a slam against Google. This announcement comes after Nokia announced its Lumia smartphones based on Windows 8, and the rival Android-based Samsung Galaxy S3 announced it sold 20 million units in its first 3 months on sale. So what to do in the smartphone world? We'll ask our special guest, Nicole Lee, who's been covering technology since 2005 with stints at Wired, Gizmodo, CNET, This Week in Tech, and now Engadget. Much of her time at CNET was spent reporting and reviewing all things mobile, with a focus on phones and smartphones. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
We also have Matt Buchanan, the editor of BuzzFeed's tech vertical FWD. Buchanan was previously the deputy editor of Gawker's Gizmodo and has contributed to American Photo, Bloomberg, The New York Times Diners Journal, and Popular Mechanics. He's been writing about tech and the way it's been changing our lives for 5 years. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Nicole, I'll start with you. What did you think in the big announcement for the iPhone 5? They went on and just so many things were changed and so many things were different about it. Did it blow you away? Was it underwhelming? What did you feel? I mean, we talked about it being kind of incremental. What was your take on
Right.
it?
I think to expect anything more than I think the problem with Apple is that they have this reputation, a huge reputation of making such amazing devices. Like, when the first iPhone came out and when the first iPad came out, and they eventually went on to be such revolutionary devices that we get kind of disappointed each incremental update. But Apple has always done incremental updates. The iPhone 4S was an incremental update over the iPhone 4. Before was an update over the iPhone 3GS before that. So I think that the problem with that the tech press and the audience in general is that we get higher expectations. And I think it was a great product. I think we got what we wanted, right? We got the LTE, we got a faster speed, we got a better camera, we got a bigger screen for those who want a bigger screen. So I think it was an improvement, really.
What did you think, Matt? What was your take in following the announcement as it happened? Were you blown away?
Well, I mean, it's a phone. So that's, I mean, in some ways, that may come down to be like the biggest problem, right? We're still talking about a thing that's fundamentally designed to do something that, like, if you think about the way smartphones are designed, they're still designed around this function that many of us don't really do with them anymore. So you have this particular constraint, and I think, I mean, I think it's impressive. What's interesting is if you look at the way they do a lot of the marketing for this and a lot of the new stuff in the phone, it comes down to a matter of the process. They talk about how they have 725 different possible inlays for each shell of the phone when they're manufacturing it. They're using a diamond cut bevel to create the chamfer along the side. So, from a hardware perspective, it's pretty impressive. I think the thing that I'm still kind of disappointed with, and I think a lot of people are, whether or not that disappointment is fair, is with the software, which has been more or less unchanged for the last 5 years. It's still the same basic interface. It still works the same way, and they've kind of built some improvements on top of that. But some of us are a little, I guess, bored, I guess you could say, with the interface. And I know that's why a lot of people, myself included, were so into, for instance, Windows Phone and the Palm Pre when it came out because it offered something different. So, you know, kind of a mixed bag. I think it's the most impressive piece of hardware around, that and the Nokia Lumia 920 that was just announced.
I guess it's hard to kind of knock Apple for just being incremental, because the last time we did that with the 4S, it ended up selling like more than any other smartphone and going completely bananas. So
it'll probably do the same for this, I think. I mean, I think it's a pretty safe bet that this will outsell the 4S, because the 4S was the one people were supposedly disappointed with because it looked the exact same. This one at least looks different. And you have all the old iPhone 4 customers coming out of their contracts. They have more international stuff now. So I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect it to outsell the 4S.
Yeah, I think those loyal to the iPhone will definitely want to have this, you know, because it does have the bigger screen. It does have LTE, which is the new faster high-speed internet. And, you know, I mean, there are a few things that, you know, I think older customers might be a little disappointed with, especially the new connector, the new 8-pin connector. Some people, you know, with older docks, with the old 30-pin connector, might be a little bit missed that they have to get all new adapters and all that. But I don't know. It kind of depends on where your loyalty lies in that sense.
Well, I think what's sort of interesting is that, so the iPhone came out in 2007. It hasn't fundamentally changed software-wise since then, and the hardware has been an iteration. I mean, it's kind of interesting, actually, that Apple had this basic design in place in 2005. If you look through the old prototypes that leaked through the Samsung trial. Anyway, like, so we've had the iPhone for a while, and I think it's really fascinating that as much competition as we have had in the smartphone market, that I still feel like only in the last year has Google come close to making a phone that's as easy to use for most people as the iPhone, that's fundamentally as good as the iPhone. And even Windows Phone, which did a lot of new and different things from an interface perspective, still was missing a lot of things that, like, features and functions you would want if you were accustomed to an iPhone. So I think that's kind of a fascinating thing. Yes, we're bored by the iPhone on some level, but it still seems like it's probably the best for most people. And that I think is sort of I kind of hate that fact in a lot of ways, but it's interesting that is still the case.
You grudgingly give Apple props for it.
Well, it's like the iPad. It seems like, you know, it's just an evolution of the iPhone interface, and nobody's made a better tablet yet. From a software perspective, like, the Kindle Fire HD is impressive in a lot of respects. The hardware for that price, but like when you're thinking about the software, I thought the Kindle Fire was kind of abysmal. It was really slow. It was hard to use and kind of confusing. And so, yes, Apple stuff is kind of boring, but like, we're at this weird place where nobody's made something that's overall overwhelmingly better. A lot of the stuff in the new Android operating system, Jelly Bean, is really cool. Like Google Now, which is their kind of like contextual search thing, it kind of just tells you about the world around you, like what temperature it is outside and when you need to catch the train to get to your next appointment. And that's really, really powerful stuff. But from an overall perspective, you know, why hasn't anybody made something that's overwhelmingly or like just clearly from top to bottom as good as or better than the iPhone?
So this is Rafa. I guess they've been very good in general at making the first initial jump of like, wow, the software, hardware. And then from there, the incrementalism, is it possible to case that incrementalism isn't Apple's forte? It's more sort of generational leaps. And now that the next wow can only come from a completely new category like TV. And that's what Apple's forte is, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair when you think about the really exciting product launches, right? It's when they're redefining or recreating a whole new category of thing, like the MacBook Air or the iPhone or the iPad. And, you know, I mean, I think that's why everybody is so attached to this idea of a new Apple television, you know, like radically redefining what is happening in the living room. And because, you know, that rumor, like, will not die. And, of course, it's probably something that they're working on. But people really, really want that to happen, because that's where the excitement comes from, is when you have this sort of brand new category of thing.
I was thinking, the thing with the Apple television, I think the reason why everyone was so excited about it was they were hoping Apple would finally revolutionize the whole cord-cutting future, right? I mean, like, you don't need the cable companies anymore, we don't need to sell at companies anymore, we can just, you know, cut our cords from the cable and go with this Apple TV thing that will hopefully have all these content partnerships, right? I mean, that's kind of what they did with music, that's what they did with the iTunes store, you know, and I think we were hoping for Apple to take that baton and run away with it and sort of lead us into the future, but we'll see if that happens or not.
But then they had to actually talk to the studios about it.
Exactly.
That's the problem. So, Nicole, are you as excited? I mean, Matt was saying he thought the Lumia phones were really interesting, and I know they have some kind of really cool features to them. Do you think they have a chance to kind of bring Nokia and Microsoft back into what basically is just a Google versus Apple world of smartphones?
I will say that the Lumia 920 is perhaps their best effort yet. Whether or not they'll actually do it is another question, because, you know, we have such loyalty to our existing products. And the big problem, I think, with the Lumia 920 and the Windows Phone in general is that it's the lack of apps. You know, do they have Instagram? Do they have Flipboard? Do they have all of these apps that, you know, iPhone users and Android users are so used to? And that's a big thing. I mean, the hardware looks great. The camera looks pretty cool. And they have all this navigation. So, I mean, the software itself looks very fascinating. It's something so different, you know. But if they don't have the apps, it's hard to say whether people will adopt it.
Yeah, that's always a knock against them. Without apps and popular apps, you know, people will always kind of question that.
I have such complicated feelings about Windows Phone, because I was really, really into Windows Phone 7 and everything they were promising to do, because I really wanted something very different, and it delivered, and it was different and good, which is like my two, after doing this for a few years, all you really want after seeing the same shit stuff all over again is things that are different and good, and this is what Windows Phone was, and they promised all these things would show up later, like, oh, we'll have the apps, oh, we'll fix this thing that isn't there, oh, we'll add this thing. And it never quite matured into a fully complete product, and the App Store was still kind of a mess. And then they just, going from Windows Phone 7 to Windows Phone 8, they kind of tossed out all of the old code. And so they're kind of starting over again from an app perspective. Like, a lot of the old apps will still work, but it sort of, they kind of rebooted, and their developers that were loyal to the platform now have to do all this work to get back on it. And so I really hope it'll work with Windows Phone 8, because it's, you know, they're launching it also with Windows 8, and it's sharing the same code base. And I would suspect when they do a new Xbox in a year or two, it'll also be running the same core. So you have this sort of really tightly interconnected ecosystem from Microsoft for the first time. But I, after getting kind of burned on Windows Phone 7, I don't know how much hope I have that they'll deliver with Windows Phone 8. I really want them to, but...
You should do a movie. You should do a movie of existential crisis of a Windows Phone fan.
That would be perfect. Well, thanks for joining us, and Nicole, good luck with your flight.
Yeah, I'm sorry for the weird location, but I'm in the airport right now.
That's okay. It's a good place to be on a smartphone.
True.
Okay, thanks for joining us. And Matt, you'll stay with us for the next segment, right?
Yeah.
So, is social media bullshit? So says former online marketer BJ Mendelsohn, who's literally calling out the top names in social media marketing, such as Seth Godin, Chris Brogan, and even media types such as Jay Rosen and Chris Anderson. In his new book, Social Media is Bullshit, his take is that social media is being packaged unfairly because each platform is very different. And this is nothing new from the marketers packaging up Web 2.0 and everything that came before it. Is social media marketing just snake oil? We'll talk to the author, Brandon B.J. Mendelsohn, who used to be in love with social media and thought it was going to be the thing to make him rich enough to retire at 30. Then he started asking questions. He's contributed to CNN, Forbes, Mashable, The Huffington Post, the Eisner-nominated Comics Alliance, and MTV's O Music Awards, all but two of which he doesn't regret. Thanks for joining us, Brandon.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So, you know, in reading your book, it's you take on some of the titans of social media marketing, and you basically, you know, say it seems more that the name of your book might be "Social Media is Overhyped," and I think what your take is that, you know, this is, it's the hype machine that you have a problem with, maybe not social media itself.
Well, you have to separate the tools from the people. You know, like Twitter, Facebook, you know, I have strong opinions about them, but they're just opinions. It's like if I go into your garage and pick up a chainsaw, you know, I could use that chainsaw for good or I could use it for evil. It's totally dependent on what your intentions are and how you're using it. So the tools need to be separated out. But what's happened is we've allowed this group of people, which I like to call the asshole-based economy, to package and sell bad information in effort to further their own financial interests. And that, yes, as you point out, is exactly what I have an issue with. And the term itself, social media, is part of that. Because just like Web 2.0, it was a made-up term that came about just as a way to repackage and sell stuff the internet has done way since the beginning.
And what kind of reaction have you got from these people? I don't know if they've read your book yet or not. I'm sure they've probably seen your opinions around. But, I mean, you do some fact-checking of their books and you do some fact-checking of some of their claims. And a lot of what you're saying is that, you know, this idea that social media will help your business and, you know, get on Twitter, get on Facebook, you're going to do great, or you're going to become famous on YouTube. And all those are basically kind of overhyping the possibilities there, that really, you know, 99.999% of people who use some of these tools to try to get famous don't really work, doesn't really work out that way.
That's right. And at 0.1%, there's always more to the story. But the response has been interesting in that they seem to be running in the other direction from me, because this is a community that really isn't often called out. You know, sometimes you'll see something in the New York Times or on the Wall Street Journal that's kind of poking holes in the companies, saying, well, you know, Facebook says this, but here's how it's actually working. So you see some of that, but it's very rare that you see someone stand up and kind of be like, hey, Seth Godin is full of crap. And so I don't think they really know how to deal with it at this point. And it's been interesting because I've had social media marketers tell me that social media works great for them, which I think is hilarious. And I've also had people tell me, oh, well, you know, I've made all sorts of money using Facebook. And I'll say, okay, prove it. And then I'll always get, this has happened to a man that this has gone on, where they all say, LOL, I can't actually prove it.
Keeping aside the social marketers and all the social media gurus that put on the title, social media for brands, existing brands, that whether it's in the, let's say, the airline industry or the cable industry, or hotel, or any other kind of industries, then using social media to interact with the users, would you not think that that's a valuable sort of incremental benefit that these companies have gotten out of social media, or even you think that is not provable so far?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things. And the first is that what I found in my research is that it's mostly a loss leader for them, but you never hear about that. You never hear that side. You'll hear them be like, oh, well, this is Pepsi saying we have all these likes and it's wonderful. But they don't tell you that their brand status has sank to number 3 in America almost simultaneously, that they've gone and done this big social media push. Or you'll have people out there like Scott Monty from Ford talking about how wonderful social media is, but you don't really, no one ever really pushes them. So they've kind of created this this fun story. And that's really all marketing is telling a story that people are going to remember and share. And so the big corporations who are investing a lot of money and not necessarily seeing a return are still out there peddling a rosy picture in order to please their shareholders. All that said, the rules are totally different for people that are famous, people who have a lot of resources, people who have a lot of money. If you're, you know, it's what I said in the book, the internet is great if you're rich. And if you've got all those resources, or if you're a Ford or a JetBlue, then absolutely, you can probably see quite a bit of a return on there in a different way than financial. Financially, there doesn't seem to be much going on there. But in terms of customer service, you know, that's just the tools being the tools.
I noticed in your book, you do kind of seem to, like one of the problems you have with social media as a thing is the application of that name to apply to a broad range of tools from Facebook to Twitter and whatnot. Could you sort of explain more as to like why you think it's wrong to necessarily group them together? Because there is something sort of in common in terms of the way they function across all of them. You know, Twitter is not exactly like Facebook. It's more of a broadcasting thing, but there does seem to be a kind of common sharing thing across them and sort of a baseline virality, I guess you could say, to each of them.
The audiences are so different, though. It's if you look at Facebook, my mom just got on Facebook, and she's now in her 60s. And the reason why she's on it is to go and track down two of her cousins that she hasn't talked to in like 25 years. And that is actually very indicative of the majority of people who use Facebook. You know, they're older women, especially in America. They're 55 plus who are using it to share pictures with their family. You know, that's pretty much the primary use. And that's actually what drove a lot of Facebook's growth. A lot of people don't realize that. It was the ability to share pictures and the lack of competition other than Flickr, which really never caught on.
Yeah, it's by far the biggest photo sharing site in the world now, like exponentially so, I believe.
And that's the big thing. You know, if you look at Twitter, you know, as you mentioned, Twitter really isn't a social network as much as it's just the way to push out news. Are actually, in a lot of cases, there's a tremendous number of comedians. People don't talk about this, but if you look at the two biggest groups of people who use Twitter among the power users, which is the 25% of the users who do the bulk of the tweeting, they're either journalists or comedians, and they're using it for the same kind of, we're going to push out either it's a news story or a new funny joke. And so, although you're right, you know, they do have that essence of, I'm going to share this thing with someone else, I think the experience is so different that it's unfair to kind of lob them together. Because what you'll do is you'll see people like Brian Solis tell you that you have to be using all these platforms, and if you don't, you know, if you don't engage, you'll die. That was his big thing back in 2007. Or you have guys like Robert Scoble who said, if you don't use all these platforms, you're leaving money on the table. And it's almost like, I kind of feel like this industry bullies people into using the platforms and tools. And part of that is rolling them all together and saying, well, you know, you're using Facebook, but for additional $200 an hour, I'll sit here and tell you how great Twitter is.
You're basically saying all the things that we want to hear, which is we don't really have to do all these things that we've been feeling like we've had to do for
That's
so
right.
long. And you also talk about Facebook's business model a little bit and how I'm guessing Twitter as well and some of these other platforms that really they are selling this story that, you know, you have to be here as brands, you need to start spending money here, you know, you're not going to survive unless you have your Facebook page and 2 trillion likes. And I mean, if that's the business and you need to start promoting it and buying ads to promote it, if I guess all these companies kind of read your book and believed what you're saying, and that would really hurt, you know, if the hype balloon gets deflated, that would really kill a lot of these platforms.
Well, but there is something to it, right? I mean, half of BuzzFeed's traffic is from social. It's from Facebook, Twitter, StumbleUpon, Tumblr, right? Like search is an increasingly tiny portion of our traffic pie. And direct visitors as I think around 25 to 30%. So, but like I think it's like 53% of our traffic comes from social stuff. So there is something to social for brands, particularly, I guess.
Well, for media, but that doesn't make any money for Facebook itself or Twitter or anything. I mean, they're only going to make money if people market and buy ads there. I mean, you're just basically using it to promote your own stuff.
Yep, sure.
There's quite a bit
without paying them, hopefully.
There was a gentleman that I spoke to at length about BuzzFeed. I was cut out from the book, unfortunately, so I can't. I don't want to rope him into it. But you know, with sites like that, which are wonderful, I am a regular over at BuzzFeed. I like checking it out. But a lot of that is kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in that you have people who are finding it through Google. Through tactics that work very well in getting ranked highly. And if you get ranked highly enough, you know, people will go and share it. Because like I said in the book, if it's something good, people are going to share it. You know, and kind of going back to what we were talking about, the whole idea that you need to have a presence on Facebook and Twitter is kind of ridiculous, because if it's good enough and if there's enough momentum behind it, people will go and do it for you and they will go and share and they will use these tools.
Well, I think it's having a presence and also having something worth sharing, right? Like It doesn't matter if you're there. If you're not putting out things that people don't care about or don't want, they're not going to share it. Right. You know, that's sort of the thing. And that kind of makes it, that's where I do find the social thing more interesting, say, than search, right? Because search has no test of quality per se. Like if you think about search spammers and the content farms, but with the social sites, I mean, with what BuzzFeed's trying to do in particular, right? It's producing content that people don't want to share. And there is a baseline there because you're asking people to do something active. You're actually asking them to, you know, put this link on Twitter or on Facebook and share it with people. So that I think is like one of the big differences with social versus like the search era before it.
That's interesting. It's definitely an interesting evolution, but I still feel like, and this goes back into, you know, what I call the asshole-based economy, and that they've tried so hard in recent years to downplay SEO, and that's kind of allowed Google to also downplay the importance of, you know, just how much traffic they send people. If you look at places like the Huffington Post, which often gets criticized for essentially manipulating the search engines, you know, Google, Matt Cutts at the South by Southwest Festival said, yes, this is a problem, and we're going to address it. But that gets buried in all of this bright and positive news about Google Plus and all of the social ways that you can generate traffic for your website. So it kind of lets Google off the hook.
There's positive news about Google Plus. Please direct me to it.
Google is always rolling out some BS about how they've seen an increase in users, but then you actually poke around and you're like, well, hey, wait a second.
They count anybody on Gmail as an active user. Like if you're signed into Google Plus and you log in, you don't have to go to the Google Plus page, but you just log into your Gmail, you're considered an active user of Plus.
Well, thanks guys for joining us. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, Nicole Lee, Matt Buchanan, and BJ Mendelson. We also want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to tune in to all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.